Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you very much for coming. Some of you I haven't seen since we made you sit through an hour of Municipal Socialism by Tristram Hunt, just before he declared he wasn't running in the Labour leadership contest. Very glad to see you. I'm sure you'll be here for subsequent weeks when we have lots of other demos seminars, and we'll be sure to let you know about them as you leave today. When I was a speechwriter in government, I was often called upon to help out one cabinet minister who had a tendency to ramble. Let's just, for the sake of argument, call him John. And John could never be sure of where he was in the speech. So I said to him, what you need to do, John, is simply tell everybody before you start how many points you've got to make. Then we know where we are. He said, thank you, that's very good advice. And in the morning, he stood up and he said, good morning, everybody. I have 47 points to make. I just have one. I want to just tell a story, for no particular reason, about a Labour leader from Yorkshire. There's a great story that Harold Wilson tells in his memoirs about meeting an Aaron Bevin for the first time. And Bevin had met Wilson's father, and Wilson's father had talked a lot about Manchester. And Bevin said, where are you really from? Because your dad keeps talking about Manchester, but you say you're from Yorkshire. And where were you born? And Wilson said, oh, in Yorkshire, we're not born, we're forged. And Bevin said, yes, I knew there was something counterfeit about you. Now, that question about authenticity and what's real in politics is one of the things we're going to talk about today. And I'm absolutely delighted that we've got Dan Jarvis will speak to us. The format will be Dan will speak for half an hour, and then he'll simply stay here and take questions and direct them himself, and I will sit there idly watching him. Thank you very much for coming. Please welcome Dan Jarvis.
Well, thank you very much, and good morning. I will endeavour to be briefer than Tristram was. The reason I'm here is that because I recently celebrated, if that's the right word, I think it is, 5 years since I was elected to Parliament in the Barnsley Central by-election. I guess it would be impossible to swap the trenches of Helmand for the green benches of Westminster without experiencing just a few surprises. The working conditions, for a start. When you once spent 2 weeks in which every single meal consisted of what was somewhat optimistically described as pork casserole, you can find it a bit hard to sympathise about some of the complaints about the food in Westminster. Or the working conditions, the hours, or the cramped offices. Believe me, it could be a lot worse. But hey, at least in the modern dynamic institution that Parliament is, I've still got somewhere to hang my sword. But there has been one way in which my civilian life has proved harder than my military life. And that's because the training that you get in the army prepares you to deal with the emotional impact of what you see. There's a job to be done, and you get on and you do it. I went to war 3 times in 3 different places, and I managed to do it all without shedding a tear, other than on the occasion, the 14th day, I was handed the pork casserole rations. But I don't mind telling you that the first time I heard my local choir, the Barnsley Youth Choir, I struggled to hold it together. And that wasn't just the music that got to me, although it was amazing. It was the thought of those talented young people, full of the joy of life, full of hope, full of ambition. It was a sorry thought that at least some of these young people, and many others like them, will be let down. It was a sense of shame that we do not do more to secure a better future for the kids in Barnsley. And more than half the youngsters in my constituency leave school without 5 good GCSEs. And my constituency is by no means unique. All over the country, there are people getting little or nothing out of the political process. Sounds hollow to those people when we talk about how prosperous Britain has become. What a great recovery it has made. Now, I do not wish to suggest that that is not true, or indeed to begrudge anyone of their success. But the purpose of my party, the Labour Party, is to give a voice to those who have not yet seen their fair share of the rewards. Those who feel that no one is listening to them. Now, I don't have as good a voice as a Barnsley Youth Choir, and I'm not going to be singing to you today, but I will do my best. So the Labour Party was founded to improve the lot of working people. There's no mystery to what it was about. Labour, work. Keir Hardie said that the British are a practical people, not given to chasing bubbles. The people I meet, the people I'm talking about, they don't attend economic seminars. They don't follow the doctrinal discussions of the Labour Party. They want to vote for a party that doesn't just oppose the government, they want a party that beats the government. A party that gets into power for a purpose, to work on their behalf. Because make no mistake, they're working very hard themselves. Now I know a woman locally called Catherine. Her story is distressingly common. Catherine is a cleaner and a housekeeper. She juggles six different jobs in six different locations. She works more than 50 hours a week on the minimum wage. And despite working very hard, Catherine struggles to make ends meet. When I asked her how she was getting on, she said to me that she'd cut down on what she described as luxuries. By luxuries, she means things like new clothes. I just work to exist, she said. Now, I know for a fact that Catherine doesn't have the time to pay too much attention to what's going on here. But the government we choose will shape her life more than most. And that's why I became an MP, to listen to people like Catherine, to speak her language and to act on her behalf. Now, one of the most painful experiences of the 2015 election campaign was talking to people on the doorstep, people who didn't really know what we stood for. Family, work and community. Those are the things that most of us think about most in our daily lives. But what did Labour have to say about those three things? What story did we have that combined the three? Even when people knew what our policies were, they didn't trust us to deliver upon them. We were talking a language from another planet. So that is why I'm rooting my remarks today in a place and an experience 175 miles away. Now, George Osborne is quick to take credit for economic growth, but look behind the headline figures and you can see that this growth is a mirage for many people. To understand why, you just need to ask two questions. First, where is the growth coming from? The Chancellor promised an export-led recovery. He talked about the march of the makers, but as Ian Wright, Labour's chair of the Biz Select Committee, has pointed out, Osborne's export target to hit a trillion by 2020 is pie in the sky. Exports as a share of our national income have fallen from 29% down to 27%. And rather than any regional rebalancing, our economy is still too dependent on financial services in the southeast. Second, who's benefiting from the growth? Working people are not gaining. Their real wages fell by £1,600 a year in the last Parliament. Recent research from the Centre for Cities found that only one in four British cities are delivering on Osborne's plan for a higher wage, lower welfare economy. And let's be clear, whilst we welcome any increases, this is not a living wage which is being introduced this year. It's a new national minimum wage. Mr. Osborne is fond of talking about fixing the roof while the sun is shining. Well, it's not the roof I'm worried about. It's the foundations. People talk about Westminster politics. Well, I think George Osborne gives us Westminster economics. Budget gimmicks, deficit reduction targets missed, and promises broken. When you hear George Osborne say long-term economic plan, what he really means is short-term political gain. And that is why people right across the country increasingly regard politics as a trade in illusion and self-interest. Cabinet ministers who want David Cameron's job are lining up to blame the European Union for every conceivable economic problem. But rather than his scare tactics on the EU, Boris Johnson might have a quicker route to number 10. Because it's not the EU that's leading this country into an economic mess. It's his leadership rival, George Osborne. So with the budget coming, I'm going to give him some advice. Stop gazing at the stars and start focusing on the foundation and deliver a budget that is in the national interest and not your own. Now, the Tories have made things worse. There's no doubt about that. But let's not pretend that all was well until 2010. It wasn't. Labour dealt with the immediate crisis of 2008, but it did not begin to get to grips with the longer-term economic crisis that affects Britain. That is why, when we get back into power, we will need to be more radical than anything that went before. I became an MP less than a year after the last Labour government left office. Many in our party felt passionate about defending our record, and others less so. And of course, the Tories sought to blame the last Labour government for everything that was wrong with our country, and they did so with a ruthless clarity. But the 2008 crisis was, in the words of the Treasury Permanent Secretary Nick Macpherson, a banking crisis, pure and simple. Labour did not cause the crash, but the place I represent certainly suffered the consequences. Crisis, which began in the deep south of America, had deep effects in every corner of our country. Small businesses found it harder to get credit. Employers began laying off wages. Homeowners struggled to pay their mortgage. The queues at the job centre got longer, and families struggled to pay for food or fuel. I defy anyone to tell me it was wrong for Labour to step in and help those people. Of course, it was the right thing to do. But if we keep fighting the battle of the 2008 crash, we are in danger of missing the central point. To understand where Labour needs to change, I think we need to look more closely at what was going on before the crisis. In the good years, when the economy was growing, when inflation was low, and when home ownership was up. Even in the good years, the benefits weren't being shared equally, because the economy was changing in ways that at the time we didn't fully understand. People in Barnsley saw on the news that Britain was booming, but they just didn't notice it in their own lives. In too many cases, work didn't pay despite the minimum wage. For the average worker, their earnings growth was slowing 4 years before the crisis hit. Too often, they had to rely on debt to get that car or new kitchen, unaware that more difficult times were around the corner. And that was for the people who were lucky enough to be in work. People who'd previously held steady, often skilled jobs in manufacturing or mining have struggled to find good employment since. In my part of the world, the Coalfields Regeneration Trust found that there are only 50 jobs for every 100 working age adults in the old coalfield communities. And what are the jobs? To many people in Barnsley, the growth industries are care homes and call centres. The pay was and is too low, and the opportunity to develop skills is too rare. Now, New Labour didn't ignore these problems. In government, their approach had three elements. The first was flexible labour markets. By keeping regulation as light as possible, it'd be easier for jobs to be created in Britain rather than overseas. The second were skills, so that workers could compete. Just down the road from my constituency in Orgreave, where the old coking plant used to sit, there is now an advanced manufacturing park, the fruit of partnerships under Boeing, Rolls-Royce, the University of Sheffield, and others. It's one of the leading hubs for high-tech manufacturing, trialling new technologies, taking on apprenticeships, and training a highly skilled workforce. The third approach was tax credits. Even if people could only find jobs that were low paid, they would benefit from a top-up to their income. I'm not saying that this approach was not without its successes, because it was. And you'll be glad to hear that I'm going to spare you the usual litany of statistics setting out the investment the Labour government made in the public realm. However, if anyone thinks that that government did nothing, I can certainly do that for you. But let's be frank, it wasn't enough. It didn't get at the root causes. New Labour were intensely relaxed about things which they shouldn't have been intensely relaxed about. And New Labour didn't see, with sufficient clarity, the downsides of globalisation. They knew it meant cheap consumer goods, but they didn't recognise that too often it meant cheap labour too. Research from the TUC found that although we boosted the incomes of the poorest, the wage gap between the top and the bottom continued to rise in the years before the crisis. And today, the average income in Barnsley is still over £100 a week less than the average income in Barnes in London. Now, I believe this gap matters. It's bad for our economy, it's bad for our communities, and it's bad for our politics too. Because if people feel the system is working against them, they will turn away from us or from politics altogether. To think otherwise reflects a poverty of ambition for any progressive party. So I say that it is a false choice to say that we must either champion Labour's record in government or denounce it. The truth is, we should defend our achievements and learn from our mistakes. To anyone outside Westminster, that is just common sense. But another truth is that insecurity and inequality on the scale we see today does not help our economy. Businesses are not prepared to invest, does not matter how cheap the labour is. If firms can't raise the capital, even skilled young people will struggle to find work. And if businesses want to invest in one industry, but the local workforce is skilled in another, the investment and the jobs will go elsewhere. And that is why the next Labour government must take a more radical approach, more radical than we had under Tony Blair, Gordon Brown and Ed Miliband. Labour must always be the party of work and jobs so that no one is left behind. If we do not share the proceeds of growth fairly, then the moral foundations of our economy are called into question. Put very simply, Labour needs to be tough on inequality, but tough on the causes of inequality. So our challenge now is to turn this into the practical action that people outside Westminster desperately want to see. And that means many things, and I cannot cover them all today, but I do want to make three suggestions to contribute to this debate. First, we need a government that is more active. Second, we need businesses that look to the long term. And third, we need trade unions that stand up for our workers. So the first change then relates to the role of government. In 2009, the Labour government under Gordon Brown led the way in coordinating action through the G20 and in a fiscal stimulus here at home. The case for a more active government could not have been stronger. But there are areas where we weren't ambitious enough. Take capital investment, which was due to fall as the last Labour government left office. At a time when borrowing costs are so low, this is the right time to make productive investments, not least in the Northern Powerhouse, which will struggle to get off the ground without proper transport infrastructure. A worker in the North, on average, has to work 18 months to generate the same economic growth that a worker in London produces in a year. And recent research from Demos found that 3 in 5 English towns are falling behind their neighbouring city in socio-economic indicators. Overcoming these regional challenges is not a provincial question, it should be a national priority. Now, part of the answer may lie in greater devolution of both powers and investment, and that's why I commend the work our Labour councillors are doing to fight for devolved power to address this inequality. But industrial strategy cannot be limited to or made purely by people within the M25. Now, part of the answer undoubtedly lies in greater research and development. The Institution of Mechanical Engineers, where we are today, was founded in Birmingham with the following mission statement: to give an impulse to invention likely to be useful in the world. I am not sure that we are yet living up to that ambition, because at the moment, Britain spends less than France, less than Germany, and less than half of what South Korea spends on R&D. And part of the answer will be found in supporting and nurturing our homegrown talent and industries. British businesses and entrepreneurs lead the world in many areas, from the creative industries to car manufacturing to aerospace. These are industries we can be proud of, industries we should back so that we can compete and win in the global market, industries where we can be proud to say, made in Britain. And when it comes to infrastructure, I know that political realities often make big infrastructure decisions extremely difficult. Let's be honest about it. MPs who represent areas along the HS2 route or under the Heathrow flight path have a tough call about whether to vote for these schemes. So let's take out the politics. Let's look at new powers to allow the government to refer major infrastructure decisions to the National Infrastructure Commission for an independent decision about whether these big projects should go ahead. The second change relates to the role of business. People in my constituency know that if their company is not doing well, they're not going to get a pay rise. So I want companies to do well. I want them to make profits. I want them to be able to use those profits to pay dividends to their shareholders, including employee owners. Where that system works well, we all benefit. As customers, we benefit from the production of new goods that we want to buy. As employees, we benefit from higher wages. And as savers, we benefit from the dividends being paid into our pensions. That is how the capitalist system should work, as servant, not as master, with a deep-rooted moral imperative supplying goods that people actually want. In Britain today, that is not how the system works. In particular, too many companies are focusing on the short-term buck rather than the longer-term value. 50 years ago, the average share in a British company was held by an investor for 8 years. By the crisis, 2008, it was down to 8 months. With high-frequency trading, it could be just 8 seconds. In this environment, shareholders aren't long-term investors. They're more like punters at the races. They aren't putting in patient capital in the hope of a steady income or a long-term reward. They're looking for a quick rise in the share price. And if that is what the investors want, then the CEOs will find themselves pressurised to deliver it. In that situation, therefore, it should be no surprise what happens. Businesses cut back on long-term investment so they can manage the short-term numbers instead. That is why we must act to encourage long-termism in business. And that means considering some radical options like rebalancing our corporate tax system, which favours risky debt over equity. And it might mean looking at the rights of shareholders so that those who own shares for longer have greater rights and those who buy in during a takeover don't get an unfair say. Rachel Reeves has argued persuasively for these and other measures to be considered to encourage long-termism. I think she's right, and I think we need to make this debate a priority. The third and final change relates to the role of trade unions. At a time when many workers feel weak, those who stand up for them must be strong. This doesn't mean a return to the 1970s. You only have to look at my constituency, the headquarters of the National Union of Mine Workers, to know that the world has moved on. And even the remaining super unions are bound by ever tighter legislation as a result of successive trade union reforms, not least the undemocratic trade union bill currently going through Parliament, a bill which, if passed by this Tory government, should be repealed by the next Labour government. Because today, the nature of work and the type of jobs available are changing. A labour market which has changed beyond recognition in my lifetime will change again as a result of automation. Our deputy leader, Tom Watson, is leading important work on how we address the challenges this creates. As he told the EEF last month, 35% of today's UK jobs have a high chance of being automated. Jobs we often take for granted as being there. Jobs like checkout assistants, cleaners, and truck drivers may no longer exist. So that's where I believe the trade union movement can play a pivotal role. Because since their foundation, trade unions have both protected and educated workers. That work continues today across the trade union movement. In my own town, Northern College works with Unison, the Bakers Union, the RMT, and Unite to provide education and training to adults wishing to learn new skills. One of the best and most recent examples refers to the steel industry. The trade union community has fought relentlessly in recent years to save Britain's steel industry and to protect those working in it. But with significant job losses taking place across the country, community aren't just shrugging their shoulders and giving up. They're working with the people who've lost their jobs to retrain them so that they can reskill and secure a bright future for themselves and for their families. And they've recently launched the Changing Work Centre in partnership with the Fabian Society. Chaired by Yvette Cooper, this will look at how we can create a progressive agenda in the modern world of work, one that has the interests of workers at its heart. And we must put the interest of workers at the heart of the most important economic decision facing this country in a generation. Alan Johnson is brilliantly leading Labour's campaign. He's making clear that the UK's continued membership of a reformed European Union is vital to British jobs, investment and exports. And the trade unions are working hard to defend important workers' rights that would be at risk if we were to leave the EU. As Tim Roach, General Secretary of the GMB, has said, does anybody actually believe that the European laws on things like maternity and parental leave, health and safety protections, equal rights for part-time workers, paid holidays and so much more would be protected by the Conservatives? Dream on if you do. And he's right, trade unions can help us make the modern economy work. But that's going to involve government working in partnership with trade unions, not punishing them. It's going to mean expanding collaboration between government and unions in areas of learning, skills, education, adopting a culture of lifelong learning. That culture is what I want for the young people in the choir who brought a tear to my eye. I want them to go out in the world charged not just with the hope that they can make a difference, but the expectation. But our country is not yet ready to receive them at the moment, and our task is to make it so, to provide the dignity of work, support for the family, and prosperity for the community. We, as a party, are a practical people, not given to chasing bubbles. We are a party of work, a party of Labour. And I think about all the battles that I fought in my life, and I know that none is more important than supporting those young people who've moved me so much. Thank you very much. Okay, now's the fun bit where you get to ask me questions. So who'd like to ask a question? I'll take them in rounds of three. If I can ask you to please state your name and say which organisation you represent. Paul.
Paul Ball from the Huffington Post. Dan, how much the test will the coming May elections be for Jeremy Corbyn's leadership? And secondly, do you think that a leader should have an automatic right to go on a ballot after a leadership challenge? Do you agree with Neil Kinnock? Anyone who can't get a large share of support from the PLP just can't do the job.
Okay, nice, easy one to start.
Well, you're not interested in the appropriate regulations for the national.
That's the third question, I'm sure.
That'd be what your news desk would want you to go on. Yeah.
Yes. Kate Bierman from Alton Taylor. Dan, you mentioned inequality throughout your speech. What measures do you think the next government specifically could take to reduce inequality further?
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, Ian Watson from BBC. I was at the Progress conference last year when you ruled out standing for Labour leadership. I was wondering if you were reconsidering. And secondly, the substance of what you were saying, you said it's a false choice between defending and denouncing the last Labour government. It's a choice which the current leader seems to have taken. He's gone to the latter approach. Why is he wrong?
Okay. Yeah, I think I'll come to your question first, Kate. I think inequality is the thing that draws us into the Labour movement. We've had a lot of people join the Labour Party recently. I think that's a very good thing, and it focuses all of our minds on what was the one thing that made us join the party. I joined when I was at university, and there was a specific moment which I remember very clearly, which was the very sad death of John Smith. And I think that moment kind of forced me to think about what I considered to be important in life, what my own values were. And my own values were the values of the Labour Party. I think there's never going to be any kind of sort of quick fit solution. There's no silver bullet solutions to resolving the issues of inequality in our local communities and around the country. But that in itself is not a reason for inaction. I think some of the things that I've spoken about today in terms of the kind of sort of the longer term investment in R&D, investment in infrastructure, the importance of education. I'm someone who's absolutely seized by the value of early years intervention, the importance of the first 1,000 days. By the time a child reaches 2, 2.5, their life opportunities are largely determined. So although it doesn't sit within the kind of natural culture of political decision making to invest money over the longer term, I absolutely think that that should be a priority for any future Labour government. The way that I describe this is that in my Barnsley central constituency, there is a ward which is called Kingston. And I want the daughter of a cleaner in Kingston to have the same life opportunities as the son of a barrister in Kingston upon Thames. That is what draws us into the Labour Party, that fight to make the country a fairer place, to level the playing field. These are kind of generational struggles, but I think it's something that the Labour Party has always had at its heart, and something that when we do get back into